from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, a specialist shares advice for parents on how to talk to kids about school shootings. We'll tell you some places you could check out for New Year's Eve dinner. Then we'll learn about Mercury retrograde and what impact it might have on our lives.
I would advise people during Mercury retrogrades to look at things more carefully and be more adaptable to change.
Plus, we'll help you plan a trip to the John Kohler Art Center and Preserve in Sheboygan.
The Art Preserve really has to be one of the most unexpected museums that I have ever visited. And, you know, winter's a great season to explore these indoor gems, so it's a great time to plan that trip.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect, from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. On Monday, a 15-year-old girl opened fire inside of a private Christian school in Madison. She killed two people before turning the gun on herself. Six more were hurt in the shooting. Two students remain in critical condition. That shooting marked the 323rd school shooting in the U.S. this year. It was the most deadly in Wisconsin this year. Many parents are having to find ways to talk with their kids about what's happening with gun violence, particularly in schools. Dr. Jenny Walczak is the clinical director of mental and behavioral health at Children's Wisconsin. She shares ways to approach the subject and help kids handle the anxiety and fear around school shootings. When it comes to the issue of school shootings, have parents talked to you about the kinds of things that they're hearing from their kids? I mean, you have two kids as well, but they're a little young. I'm guessing one is probably in school.
Yes. Parents are concerned about safety. Parents are concerned about how much to share with their children about these school shootings, how to prepare their children but not scare them, and then how to deal with the fallout of this most recent school shooting and how to talk to their kids about it. And so a lot of that too, it really depends on the age of the child. So, you know, as you mentioned, Joy, I have two young children who generally do not have any exposure to this, but for school age kids who may have more exposure via social media or TV, or it was talked about at school, this is a real reality for parents right now to figure out, what am I going to do? How am I going to handle this? The advice I give parents are start with where your child is at. So find out what they know. Ask them what they've heard, what their fears are, what their questions are, just so you can get that pulse before you dive in and start giving them more information than they need, because we don't want to give them information that there is going to alarm them or make them more anxious than they already are. So it's really starting that conversation with just asking your kid what they've heard and then kind of taking that conversation from there to provide more information, to clarify information. So they may have heard something that you know is completely incorrect.
You know, as you say, children are going to have varying levels of exposure to this issue. Is there an age that is simply too young to talk about this? Or, you know, do you find that out through asking them questions, getting kind of where they're at right now? How do you navigate these very difficult conversations, even for adults to have, with young children who might not and probably don't understand the nuances of these conversations?
So there is not a hard and fast rule around age. You know, you can look at a five-year-old and you may have a more developmentally advanced five-year-old or a five-year-old who's a little bit more on the, you know, the socially immature side of things. And so parents know their kids best. I think a lot of this plays into values too, Joy, and what a family feels is right and what is important to them in terms of having this conversation when they're navigating it with young children. Some parents feel like it's important to bring this up in a child-focused way. We don't want to be explaining details and things that a 5-year-old or younger child is just not going to understand or that they need to know, because they're not going to developmentally be able to process that information. But some families feel it's important to talk about these, and they maybe take the approach of talking about safety and how to be safe at school and how to keep yourself safe, talking about fears. And so maybe some things that the child fears, and problem solving. Well, what could you do if that's your fear? How could you handle that? And having the parent work through that with the child. It goes back to, you know, the parent knows their child best. What's important to the parent in terms of either providing or choosing not to provide that information? And I think there's not a right or wrong answer there.
You know, inside of that, you talked about safety. And one of the challenges that I think a lot of us are having, even in our own internal dialogues, is this issue of the illusion of safety and trying to, you know, convince ourselves that we have some kind of control over situations that, you know, over the last couple decades, it's become increasingly clear we have very little control over. How do we empower children in a situation where many of us feel powerless?
Yeah, it's so difficult, because even as we, you know, and I referenced earlier, talking to, you know, having this conversation with your child, part of what you want to put forward in that conversation is, you know, reassurance that they're safe. And that's really hard to do right now, because I think many adults, probably many children, don't feel safe right now. But we know that in traumatic situations, having a resilient adult who can help provide that sense of safety to the child is critical. And so we have to, before we as adults go into these conversations or talk to kids, we do need to kind of check ourselves, check our feelings, our own anxiety, and think about how can we give this child some concrete information and things that they can do if they're not feeling safe. Really hard to do. With the school shooting, I think two things that parents can do is, one, reassure the child that people in our community, people in their school, are looking to this event that occurred to figure out what they can learn to make their school that much safer. I think the second thing that parents can do is, unfortunately, have the conversation around, many schools are doing intruder drills, just like we prepare for fire drills or if there were an earthquake. And so talk to your kid about that experience. What's it like when you do an active intruder drill? What do you learn? What are you supposed to do? And reinforcing that information with them. Part of it is also reminding them that these events are rare. Although right now it does not feel rare, and it's all over the media, and it feels like this pylon of multiple events that we've seen happen across our country, they're still rare. And so reminding them of that piece, and then helping them know that they do have the tools, because they're teaching them in school what to do. You can reinforce those things at home should this happen. It's hard, I think, for me, for parents, for many, just to process that we have to prepare our kids for this situation. It's disheartening.
It's a conversation we've been having for about 2 decades at least. And we're having this larger conversation of, yes, trying to make schools safer. And so I think for a younger child having these conversations, I think that will be enough to kind of persuade them, okay, I'm going to feel safe. But when you have an older child, when you have even a child who's in middle school, in high school, I wonder if that's going to be enough, and how we discuss these issues with children who are older. How do we deal with these kind of deeper questions that older children will have?
Yeah, and that is a tough spot to be in, because an older child is able to process and understand what they're seeing. They're watching the news, they're hearing their parents talk, they're hearing the other kids at school talk about this. So this is really a reality. I think adults can really try to get to what is the fear for that teen, and trying to understand what they fear, what they're worried about is going to happen, and then trying to help them work through that anxiety. Because we can't take this away, right? We're not going to take away the active shooter drills. There are many larger things that are going to need to happen, I think, before we can, you know, say that this is never going to happen again, if that will ever be a reality. But I think unpacking what that fear is and then helping your kid cope with that anxiety. Because, you know, we have some kids who are going to experience some anxiety around this event, but with time, with having conversations, it's going to go away and things, you know, life is going to resume. Other kids, that anxiety is really going to persist. They're going to be fearful. They're going to have intrusive thoughts. They're going to, you know, maybe stop eating. They're going to have all those signs of an anxiety disorder that then really rises to the level of potentially needing some therapy to talk through those issues and more formally address them. Because it may reach a point where, you know, a parent really feels out of their league with being able to support their teen with their mental health. You know, it's figuring out when is this crossing the point of my teen is so anxious that it's affecting their functioning that we maybe need some more help for them to be able to work through and process this.
Sure. Well, Jenny, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Jenny Walczak is the Clinical Director of Mental and Behavioral Health at Children's Wisconsin. This conversation was recorded in 2022. If you'd like to listen to Lake Effect as a podcast, you can search us wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen to all of our shows on demand. When you visit an art museum, you usually find art hung on the walls or displayed in galleries. Later in the show, we'll tell you about a Wisconsin museum where the art can be found in more unexpected places.
The bathrooms are, one of the absolute standout things about this place.
Coming up, we'll also explore some of the best spots in Milwaukee to experience fine dining this New Year's Eve. But first, an astrologist explains Mercury retrograde. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Astrology. For some, it's nothing more than pseudoscience. For others, it's a tool to help plan life, something to point to when things aren't going their way. Some of us here at WUWM have noticed that things just kept going wrong these last couple of weeks. That led to a discussion about the astrological concept of Mercury retrograde. So WUWM's Mayan Silver called up a local astrologer to learn more.
My name is Brett Dieras, and I am an astrologer and tarot reader and consultant.
Okay, awesome. And when you say consultant, is it like what kind of consulting?
I do mostly business consulting now. I do business consulting using astrology and tarot.
Dieras has been into astrology ever since he was a kid, back when the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had its beloved green sheet. It was a spearmint green section of the paper that had lighter fare, like cartoons, celebrity news, and horoscopes.
Every day, my mom and I would look at our horoscopes, like, oh, what's going to happen today? How is today going to transpire? And, you know, just out of curiosity.
Later in life, Dieras found himself at an event in Waukesha.
And I decided, I was like, you know what? They have an astrologer here. Why don't I just take some time and sit down with her and see, you know, what this is all about? And I was totally blown away at the accuracy, the detail, and just her knowing things about me that I never would have expressed.
Dieras was hooked. He found classes to better understand the practice.
Because astrology is I like to think of it as like a divine blueprint of how you're created. You know, so it is a map of your strengths, your weaknesses, your challenges, the progressions that you go through in life, and how you change as a person.
Many people are skeptical about astrology. They say it's too difficult to test scientifically, it's impossible to prove, and sometimes it seems to offer conflicting information. Others love it. What everyone can agree on, though, is that the planets do exist. Mercury is one of the closest planets to Earth. According to NASA, it orbits the Sun in less than 90 days. At points of the year, it looks like Mercury is moving backwards in its orbit around the Sun. That's what's referred to as Mercury retrograde.
And you're asking specifically about when Mercury goes retrograde?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So Mercury retrograde, yeah. It happens about 3 to 4 times a year, lasting about 2 to 3 weeks each time. It's caused by all the planets moving at different speeds from one another.
So it does create the optical illusion of Mercury moving backwards in the sky.
National Geographic reports that Mercury retrograde was probably first documented by Babylonian astronomers around the 7th century BCE. There's no scientific evidence that Mercury retrograde affects us, but astrologers believe it does. Astrologers say that Mercury, like all planets, represents an aspect of our lives.
Ultimately, like Mercury as a planet is the planet of communication, and it goes back to the myth of Hermes and Mercury being able to travel between the world of Olympus to the underworld. Like Mercury was the only planet that could do that. So Mercury represented communication and commerce and how we think and how we operate, and some technological things can be represented by Mercury, but ultimately it's communication. And so when Mercury moves backwards in the sky, or appears to move backwards in the sky, sometimes the signals can get a little crossed. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the signals can get crossed.
Deira says that when a planet looks like it's moving backwards or in retrograde, astrologers posit it signals a state of change, a bit of impermanence, unstable foundations, if you will. With Mercury, astrologers say that means communication mishaps. We just went through a period of Mercury retrograde from November 25th to December 15th, and I felt like lots of weird things happened to myself and my friends and coworkers. So I decided to quiz Dieris with a few of those situations, asking him if astrologers would attribute them to Mercury retrograde. Ordering the wrong drink, perhaps.
Possibly, you know, because sometimes it's a communication mishap.
Problems with your employment contract.
Contracts, because Mercury does relate to communication, yes. I do think that double-checking, sometimes with the Mercury retrograde, you just have to double-check. You know, like check to make sure your I's are dotted and your T's are crossed. And so, yes, contract errors can be very Mercury retrograde related.
What about having someone being scheduling an appointment and having that person not show up like multiple times?
No.
That's not Mercury retrograde?
No. If it's a repeating pattern like that, no.
Okay. What if it happens once?
If it happens once and it is due to a communication mishap, like let's say your reminder didn't go off on your phone, that can be very Mercury retrograde related.
As an astrologer, Dieris has a way to deal with that.
Well, you know, I think it's best to always stay out of your fear-based mindset. You know, if opportunities come up during Mercury retrograde, you know, just be prepared to look over contracts once or twice. Have somebody else look over a contract. If you're, you know, let's say buying a car, have somebody else look at the car. It just means you have to go over it multiple times. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's totally going to be an ultimate failure and everything is going to go wrong. It just means that it needs another set of eyes on it. So I would advise people during Mercury retrogrades to look at things more carefully and be more adaptable to change, you know, so it challenges us to kind of deal with ambiguity in a little bit you know, in a little bit different way. You know, it makes us need to be adaptable and flexible and allow ourselves a little bit more space and time instead of rushing. That would be my biggest advice for how somebody would deal with a Mercury retrograde or any planetary retrograde.
It turns out that besides Mercury, there are a lot more planets that can retrograde. And astrology has something to say about all of it.
You know, there's a Mars retrograde and Jupiter retrograde that go into 2025 until about February. And then in March, Venus goes retrograde. And so that extends that retrograde season. So, you know, adapting to change and being flexible, I think, is really going to help us in the coming year.
What's the difference when depending on what planet goes into retrograde? Like, are there differences? Is it all the same thing? I mean, you said, and according to astrology, Mercury deals with communication, but yeah.
Mercury deals with communication. Mars is the planet of action, drive, passion, is also a planet that deals a lot with commerce because Mars represents like the hot commodity. So like it's really that has an effect on like our energy levels and our forward momentum and our movement. Venus is the planet of love, beauty, relationships, our values. So a lot of times Venus retrogrades will bring back specific people or specific relationship patterns. Jupiter is the planet of growth and expansion, and it's a very spiritual planet. So it's about transcendence, growth, and expansion. And so when Jupiter goes retrograde, a lot of times you won't see that forward expansion and you'll have a sense of optimism, but nothing will go in your way. So you have to use that as a planning time. So using retrogrades as a time of like planning, I think is really helpful, you know, because the universe gives you that cue of like, okay, things are in motion, go forward. And things are not in motion when planets are in retrograde or they're going backwards.
Deira says astrology has been a tool for him in his life.
Like, I'm somebody who needs to know the why. I need to know why is this happening. I need to be able to see what is going on that's causing this. So I'm a very, I can be a very technical and a very analytical thinker that way.
Are you a Gemini?
I'm a Gemini rising.
Oh, okay.
I am, but I'm a Capricorn. I'm a very earthy person.
Deira says his astrological placements translate into a need to know everything.
And so for me, astrology answered the question of why. Why am I stressing out about this? Why am I having a panic attack? Why am I so hyper fixated on my health? Why am I OCD about how I keep my house? You know, why am I this way? And astrology answered that for me.
Astrology isn't for everyone, but like Deira's, some use it to fill in the gaps. For others, life without it would just be a lot less fun. For Lake Effect, I'm Maya on Silver.
Deiris is an astrologer, tarot reader, and consultant in Metro Milwaukee. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver about Mercury retrograde. And just a heads up, Mercury will again be in retrograde starting in March. Christmas is just around the corner, and many of us are figuring out our plans for the next big event, New Year's Eve. While many New Year traditions focus on drinking and partying the night away, others focus on good food and fine dining. There are many fine eateries in the city where you can celebrate, but if you're looking for something a bit above and beyond the ordinary, Lori Frederick has you covered. Frederick is the dining editor for On Milwaukee, and she joins me now to share some of the best meals you can enjoy this New Year's Eve. Lori, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure.
So if you are a person who is looking to go out on New Year's and you're hoping to have more than a liquid diet for the evening, There are a lot of different options here in Milwaukee. We're going to look at a few of them today. The first one is a restaurant that is named for a god that I think would be very into New Year's celebrations.
Yes, yes. Bacchus. Bacchus. One of the longer running Bartolotta restaurants. They do a beautiful job there as far as, you know, a fine dining experience. And they have a really nice setup for New Year's Eve. It's a three-course menu, but you have options, and there's some really nice things on there. I mean, you can upgrade your dinner with, like, caviar service, and you have a couple of choices as far as caviar goes. You can get an amber regalis caviar or an aceta caviar. I mean, like, if you know and love these things, you know, you have choices. And then from there, there's a three-course menu that has everything from, like, a tuna crudo to a crepe with Rush Creek Reserve cheese in it. There's oysters, lobster bisque, lots of different choices, fancy things that make you feel nice. You have things like pork ossobuco, Scottish salmon, scallops. You can go as far as lobster tail if you like. And then desserts, which they've always done a beautiful job with desserts at Bacchus, from like a chocolate truffle dessert with a hazelnut custard to a gâteau with black tea poached pears and caramel and little filled profiteroles. And then you can always go the very French route and opt for the Wisconsin cheese course at the end of your meal, which they offer. And they're really good in their sourcing as far as cheeses go. So lots of good options there. And this is the sort of thing where you can go out to dinner and then go to a traditional party. Or you can just, you know, I think a lot of people just want to be, have an enjoyable evening somewhere and maybe be in bed by midnight. Who knows?
Now, if you're looking for something that is, I don't know, I would say in some ways a bit more decadent, but also something you can do for a bit longer. Let's say you don't want to go out on New Year's Eve. You're looking to do something, though, with a group maybe before the festivities of New Year's Eve. There is Esther Ev.
Yes. And Esther Ev is kind of exciting if people haven't been there more recently. They moved into new quarters this year, and they're right on Connecticut Avenue. It's actually in the former Ceviche restaurant, which they've redone to reflect more of the Esther Ev personality. And they are doing their end-of-year dinner, I guess, their New Year's Eve dinner, starting on December 28th. And going through the 31st. I think it's partially because they only accept a few slots. You know, it's a smaller restaurant. There's only a few slots every night that they can accommodate. But I think it's also to kind of spread it out. You know, not everybody wants to be in the fray on New Year's Eve. Some people just want to stay home. And this is good for people like me who might want to say, hey, the 28th sounds like a better day to do this. And they are doing a 10-course dinner. Surprisingly, when you think about that, it's 10 courses for $125, which is a really, really nice deal. You can add beverage pairings for an additional $65. But there's going to be courses with crab, veal tartare, lobster, beef Wellington, for sure a bûche de Noël for dessert. And if I know the chefs, including Dan Jacobs, they also really, really love to do their signature hash brown potato with caviar as one of the starting courses. So you might also expect that.
I'm not familiar with that item, a bûche de Noël.
So the bûche de Noël is like the very traditional French cake. It's built to resemble a Yule log. So it's like a little log, and it's a rolled cake. So it can be done in a variety of ways. I don't know if it's traditional to have a white cake, you know, but you'll have some sort of like custard filling. And then it's frosted to look like a Yule log and usually surrounded by little like meringue mushrooms. I've been to a few places. Betterment, which is now gone, did a bûche de Noël last year. And their pastry chefs did little miniature bûche de Noëls, which were the most adorable little logs with little teeny tiny meringue mushrooms around them. Very much a reflection of the celebration of the Yule, you know.
Now, if you're looking for something maybe a bit different, you don't necessarily want to do kind of American cuisine or cuisine that you might be more familiar with, just outside of Milwaukee, I believe, is Elder and Rhyme.
Yes. And Elder and Rhyme has a new chef. Chef David Cook is over there, and he is planning on a night in Morocco. And this is in addition to their regular menu, which is also available that evening. If you sign on for the special night in Morocco dinner, you can expect things like a lamb tagine, scallops with saffron couscous, ending with like pistachio baklava. So something really different. If you're not into caviar bumps and, you know, and crab and lobster, it sounds like it will be, you know, a delicious departure.
Now, Birch is another restaurant on this list. They are also doing a coursed out dinner similar to Estrev and Bacchus. Mm-hmm. What does theirs look like?
Yeah. If you're familiar with Birch, it's very, very fresh, very seasonal, and influenced by what they can cook over their hearth, their open hearth. So they always start out with little amuse-bouche kind of items. So he'll be serving canapés, and that's things like celery root tacos with caviar and a carrot tartare with shiso to kind of bump that up. There's five courses from there. One is with tuna. There's a smoked steelhead trout course. There's a pasta course. They're also known for handmade pastas. So it's a squash-filled pasta that's served with lobster and tarragon. The next course is a ham course with like kind of a ham with eggs and marinated kale. And I'm describing this and what it will look like to you on the plate. Their food is beautiful, you know, and I think it's funny because you say it out loud and it sounds
it sounds
ordinary,
like ham and eggs.
But it's going to be it's going to be way, way more exciting than what it sounds like. And then there's what you would consider the main entree, there's a wood roasted beef with a cabbage dish. And then they'll have some chocolate mousse and apparently a cotton candy dessert, which I'm intrigued about. You know, like, I want to know, does that come with sparkling wine? I don't know. We'll have to see. Surprises await.
Now, the final place we'll look at, similar to Birch, they really go for fresh foods, seasonal foods. Mm-hmm. What can we expect from Calucenzo?
Calucenzo.
Calucenzo.
Calucenzo is known for their regional Italian cuisine. You'll always find fresh handmade pastas there, different things, but they're also, in being true to the regionality of Italy, they have beautiful fish dishes, a lot of great braised meats and different things. And every year they come up with a new awesome menu for New Year's. And seeing some of the things that they've done in the past, you know, you might see white truffles. You'll probably definitely see something like a scallop dish, a fancier pasta. It's a multi-course. I believe she said it was five courses. And they will be deciding exactly what's on that menu in the week before when they see what's available, what's freshest, what's best. And I think that's a pretty cool, if you're able to put your trust in what you'll find there. And if you've eaten at Calucenzo, you know that, I mean, I don't think I've ever had a bad course there. So they'll have something really, really special planned. And those reservations will go fast, whether people know what's on the menu or not. So, in fact, most of these, I would say that if you want to get in on whatever they're serving, get your reservation in sooner than later.
All right. Well, looking forward to the new year and some lovely meals in the meantime. Lori, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Lori Frederick is the dining editor for On Milwaukee at WUWM.com. You can find some of our previous conversations about Milwaukee area restaurants. We'll help you plan a trip to the John Kohler Art Museum in Sheboygan and tell you about some of the unique things you can see there next in our series, Wandering Wisconsin. You're listening to Lake Effect, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. You may be looking for something to keep the kids busy over winter break, or a way to fill up a cold winter day. Well, today, Wandering Wisconsin has just the place for you, the John Kohler Art Museum and Preserve in Sheboygan. Right now, they're celebrating 50 years of their artist-in-residency program called Art Industry. It allows 12 artists to work inside the Kohler Company Foundry, giving them access to industrial materials, processes, and technologies. And perhaps most importantly, access to the Kohler factory workers to learn their trade. The art produced by the residents is on full display right now at the museum. To help you plan a trip and find out what you'll see there, Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen is joined by Jody Throckmorton, the museum curator, and Amanda Weibel with Travel Wisconsin.
I recently visited the museum, and one thing that stood out to me is this blending of hard work and artistry. Mm-hmm. Metalworking and forging, these are not easy jobs, but they do result in something really beautiful. So can you talk about how that's sort of shown through the art at the museum?
Absolutely. I think the factory certainly has an effect on the artist's practice, not only in what they're making, but I think in how they make. It's a common misconception, I think, that the artists coming in are people already familiar with ceramics or metalsmithing. And it's sometimes artists that have never worked in either material, which is also incredibly exciting. But I think your point about the labor in some ways being visible in the work that's made is very true, because I think that's one of the things that artists and factory workers, for example, really connect on. This is a moment when they're approaching a process or a material, perhaps for different reasons. One for industry and to make, toilets or sinks or whatever it may be, and the other for a more visual or conceptual reason. Not that there's not crossover between those, of course, but they're uniting in the middle over this idea of making and craft. And I think that really drives it.
I'd also really like to talk about the Preserve. So there's the main Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan, but just a couple miles away, there's the Preserve. And this place is, I think, so cool and unique. It mainly features folk art, but it focuses on artist-built environments. So can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So the Art Preserve was built 3 years ago. And an artist-built environment is something that the Art Center, it's a field that the Art Center has really been instrumental in developing. It's a really unique form of art making where the spaces have been so significantly transformed by an artist that it's like the artist's art and life are all in one. And so that, and with that said, there's a whole range of environments. We have 35 on view right now, which is really extraordinary. And it represents collecting that has been going on for a very long time at the Art Center. To talk about Ruth Kohler and her vision, she was someone who recognized that museums really were not collecting this type of work. It was being forgotten. It was being left behind. And so she worked hard to see how this is an emerging genre that artists really work through and point to some really, frankly, important things related to American history and American art history. And how do we become an institution that can support this type of work? And it's really about being artist-led in what we do, going back to the residency, right? That was Ruth listening to the artists and saying, wow, what could we do in this factory? It's very similar with the artist-built environments. It was Ruth and the many curators that have come after her that have recognized how artists are working in this mode.
The first time I went to the museum, it was to see the Rhinestone Cowboy House, but I was so impressed by the scale of some of the other environments, particularly the healing machine on the third floor. That was such a delightful surprise to walk into for the first time. Can you talk about these two artist environments and maybe share a favorite of yours?
Absolutely. Those are two of my favorites. So you picked very well, I think, but I will also share another one as well, because there are many. But the Rhinestone Cowboy House is by an artist named Loy Bolin, who called himself or really became the original rhinestone cowboy. So he would dress in incredibly beautiful, dazzling outfits that he made himself with rhinestones and glitter. And he would do performances in fairs or flea markets or shopping plazas. And he would dance and play music and tell jokes and all sorts of things. He even, I will add, had a, I believe it was a Cadillac, covered in rhinestones as well. So he had an entire persona. At the art preserve, what you'll find is his home, which he called the Beautiful Holy Jewel Home. And so it too is covered in rhinestones, as well as in the interior construction paper covered with more glitter and rhinestones. And so we because of the work of And this is true for a lot of the things at the art preserve and would be good to share for those that might say, oh my gosh, there's someone in my town that does this type of work, right? Has really transformed their living space into a work of art, is that it's often one person who recognizes that this is a special thing and that it needs to be preserved that brings it to the attention to of people like us. And so an artist, Katie MD, actually brought it to the attention of the art center. And we were able to collect his entire house from Mississippi. And so you can come in and see all that the Rhinestone Cowboy was about. There's also videos you can actually watch him, because so much of it is about that sort of persona that he really inhabited and became. And then the healing machine is, I think everyone, this is my plug, but I think everyone in Wisconsin and we can wish the world needs to take a yearly pilgrimage to the healing machine, because it's an incredibly special work of art, and perhaps it even transcends what a work of art is. It's by a man named Emery Blagden, and he inherited a property in Garfield Table, Nebraska, which is in western Nebraska, and he started to make objects that he thought could channel healing properties from the earth. He had a history of cancer in his family, so he really wanted to create a space that could be healing through, you know, magnetic fields, electric currents, really harnessing the earth's natural energy. And so very luckily, a man that had known Emery found out that the piece was up for sale at auction and managed to rescue it. And it found its way happily to us at the Art Center. And so while we can't exactly recreate what would have been like in Garfield Table, Nebraska, in that shed, you are able to walk through and get a sense of what Emery was trying to do with this incredible healing machine and the work that he was making.
I love that idea of a yearly pilgrimage. Right? It is that special. It is. We can't talk about either of these museums without talking about the bathrooms. They're kind of hard to describe, and each is unique, but they're these works of art just on their own. So what can you share about the bathrooms?
Yes. The bathrooms are, one of the absolute standout things about this place. I think every facet of life should be filled with art. And the bathrooms are part of that too. And really they do stem from the arts industry residency and the work that Kohler Company has done with their artist edition series and things like that, because they all are artist design bathrooms. And so that's early on by artists like Matt Nolan and Cynthia Cosentino, who did some of the first restrooms at the Art Center that are talking about male and female bodies and how they operate in these spaces. One of my favorites is Anne Agee, and that's also at the Art Center. And that's in that sort of blue and white Dutch ware style. But she spent a lot of time in Sheboygan in the area, really looking at water and the importance of water, not only Lake Michigan, but looking at different water plants and car washes, even bottled water at the grocery store. And in these bathrooms, I would say every detail has been thought through. The toilets are designed by the artist, the sinks, and on and on. And then at the Art Preserve, they did a really incredible job commissioning two Wisconsin artists, actually, Beth Lippman and Michelle Grabner. Beth is located in Sheboygan Falls and Michelle in Milwaukee. as well as an artist duo from Philadelphia, Paul Swenbeck and Joy Feasley, to make restrooms there. And you'll be happy to know that on the third floor, Paul and Joy's restroom is inspired by the healing machine. And so, you know, while you're doing something that is incredibly basic, you're looking in the mirror, you're, you know, you're in the bathroom, something that we all do frequently, right? It still can be a transformative experience through art. So it's one of the best things about the Art Center.
It really is. I didn't know that about the healing machine. So that's so fascinating. All right, Amanda, I'm going to turn to you. If the bathrooms at the Art Museum aren't enough for people, they can also go visit the Kohler Design Center, which is nearby. What can you share about that place?
Well, if you're a fan of interior design and history, you are going to love the Kohler Design Center. It's a three-level building showcasing all the latest products and designs and technology, so you can wander through the open showrooms and get a feel for the latest faucets, sinks, and more. You can check out some model bathrooms and kitchens to really get some great inspiration. And don't forget to visit the company museum in the basement either. That's where you're going to learn about the history of the Kohler family, the company, and the community while marveling at some of their original designs. And through the Kohler Design Center too, you can also book tours of the Kohler factory. So I definitely recommend taking a tour. Those tours are led by retired factory workers. So they just have decades of knowledge and personal experience that just makes those tours so special. It's a fantastic behind the scenes look at the skill and the artisanship behind each and every product.
What else might people want to do on a trip to the Sheboygan area?
You know, Sheboygan has activities for all interests. If you are traveling with a young family, check out the Above and Beyond Children's Museum. They have tons of hands-on interactive exhibits, and every different floor has a different theme. You know, as we head into winter, if you're an adrenaline seeker, maybe you want to try some winter surfing. That might be something you've seen out on Lake Michigan in the Milwaukee area too, but Sheboygan's location along the shore really produces some of the best waves on Lake Michigan. And Sheboygan's actually been named the Malibu of the Midwest. So great place for surfing, and you don't have to be a pro. The EOS Surf Shop right in Sheboygan offers surf lessons to beginners. So something fun to check out, and honestly, even just fun to watch if you don't want to surf yourself. Another great recommendation is Three Sheeps Brewing Company. That's a well-known brewery that's based in Sheboygan, and visitors are welcome to tour the brewery. You maybe have tried their beers throughout the state in different restaurants and bars, but they also have some taproom exclusive beers to check out.
And how about for people who want to make a weekend out of visiting the Sheboygan area? Where would you recommend they stay?
For an absolutely unforgettable weekend stay, you're going to want to do the American Club. This is Kohler's iconic resort, and it's the only hotel in Wisconsin to receive AAA's Distinguished Five Diamond Hotel Award. I mean, this is a complete sensory experience throughout the entire stay, from the delicious homemade turtle chocolates that will await you in your room when you check in, to the water-based therapies at the Kohler Water Spa. You are just going to be stunned by the hospitality and attention to detail. Another fantastic option for families is the Blue Harbor Resort. It has this iconic coastal looking feel to it, and there are a ton of activities and things to do while you're there. One of the main attractions at the Blue Harbor is an indoor water park that's called Breaker Bay, and that's going to be fun for the whole family. They have a lazy river, they have water slides, pools, of course, a surf simulator, and more. And finally, you know, for another historic experience, stay at the Rochester Inn in Sheboygan Falls. This bed and breakfast has been operated as a hotel since 1848, and each room is just beautifully designed in this timeless look that's going to be perfect for couples.
Okay, Jody, if folks from the Milwaukee area are looking for something to do this winter, why would you tell them to make the trip to Sheboygan to check out the museum?
Well, I'd say that there is a treasure in everyone's backyard in Wisconsin, and that's the Art Center and the Art Preserve. It's a collection that is internationally renowned, but it has such local connections, and I think a lot, there's honestly something for everyone to experience. And we didn't even talk about the performances and programming that we also have going on as well. So our website is always up to date with that information, and you might be able to catch another exciting performance or dance or something going on. There's always something happening at the Art Center, and it's an exciting place.
And what about you, Amanda? Why would you recommend people go check out that museum?
I think the Kohler Art Center upends many people's perceptions of art in Wisconsin. art and culture really isn't limited to the biggest of the big cities in Wisconsin. In communities of all sizes, we support the arts, and really in some unexpected ways. And the Kohler Art Center is just a perfect example of this. It's this incredible free museum that's been ingrained in the community for more than 50 years. You know, as Jody mentioned, displays work from renowned artists, and it also just fosters the talents and creativity of artists through their programs like the Arts Industry Residency. I also think that the Art Preserve really has to be one of the most unexpected museums that I have ever visited. And, you know, winter is a great season to explore these indoor gems, so it's a great time to plan that trip. And there's so much else to do in the Sheboygan area that you are going to have no trouble putting together an itinerary for a really memorable winter getaway.
Jody Throckmorton is the chief curator at the John Kohler Art Center in Sheboygan. Amanda Weibel is the communications officer for Travel Wisconsin. They spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen as part of our series Wandering Wisconsin. To find other winter travel suggestions, visit WUWM.com or check out the Wandering Wisconsin podcast. And a note to our listeners, the Kohler Foundation is a financial contributor to WUWM. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Still looking for a last-minute gift? Locally purchased books are always a good option. And tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll have some recommendations. Plus, Bubbler Talk will get to the bottom of a mystery building in the Milwaukee area. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.